Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5 and Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I am pleased to be connecting this morning via Zoom with Dr. Art Seer, Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals across the country and indeed outside our borders as well. And Professor Seer also makes time for WUWM in Milwaukee and makes time for WGTD's morning show. And I am grateful to him, as always, for these opportunities to speak with him about a variety of topics and issues, and chiefly those which he writes in his insightful column. Professor Seer, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you. How can I refuse with such gracious introductions? You're very kind.
Glad to be talking to you. It occurred to me as I looked over your last four columns that have been published since the last time we spoke on the air that although I knew this about you, I guess it really struck me how much of a historian at heart you are, in that three of these four columns focus very squarely on matters one way or another that are in our past and yet that speak to the present. But I'm really struck by your love of history and also your appreciation for the significance of history, something which I think is probably lost on a lot of people. Have you always had this interest in history?
Yes. Well, thank you again for kind remarks. Yes, it's important to put things in the context of time and history, and that's true whatever you're doing for a living. Especially for us Americans. We're so forward-looking and so contemporary. We can learn a lot from other cultures that are more sensitive to the context in which they operate.
I appreciated a column in which you pointed to something that occurred in earlier this fall, I think it was maybe the middle of September, and an event which passed almost without any mention whatsoever, at least in terms of the mainstream media. And I'm talking about the dedication of a very special memorial on, I believe, September 17th. Tell our listeners what happened on September 17th and why you wanted to be sure to draw our attention to it as you drew your readers' attention to it.
Well, our leaders in Washington, especially in Congress, in their wisdom, have planned, implemented, and put in place, and we taxpayers have paid for it, a gigantic, and I mean gigantic, memorial to Dwight Eisenhower. 4 acres, no less, in Washington, is devoted to this huge, almost imperial, not monument, but series of monuments to the much admired and rightly admired, and in my view, great president, as well as commander of Allied forces in the European theater in World War II, Dwight Eisenhower. It's been a long time in the planning, and they hired a celebrity architect by the name of Frank Gehry, who deals mostly with Hollywood personalities, both in front of and behind the cameras, and major corporate executives and political leaders. Who have large egos and are able to pay for big memorials to themselves or very, very luxurious homes. Very interesting choice. Very interesting phenomenon.
One of the things you mentioned in your column is that this memorial was commissioned way back in 1999. So it's been over 2 decades in the making. Tell us more about whatever you know about that process.
Well, they, as usual with presidential memorials, they were engaged in a fair amount of long-term fundraising, but also there was a lot of disagreement over the plans and implementation. The late president's 2 granddaughters were highly opposed to the original design, and they're still apparently alienated from the project. His grandson, David Eisenhower, was initially put off by Gehry's design. He's been much more diplomatic and hasn't said much at all about it. But the usual to-ing and fro-ing took time. The memorial to FDR took a lot longer. It was initially, the initial effort was in the late 50s, and FDR was still a controversial president, even though his Democratic Party controlled Congress. It got sidelined for many years. So it's not unusual for the Eisenhower Memorial to take so long. The fact that it's so gigantic, obviously, is particularly notable. And I guess a sign of the times in which we live, there was almost no mention of it in the press. To your earlier point that we tend to focus much more on contemporary and current preoccupations than on our own past.
One of the things you mentioned in your column is that the grandiosity of this memorial, in a sense, is at odds with who Dwight D. Eisenhower was. That chances are, if we were to ask him or to show him what has ensued, he would probably in some ways be maybe embarrassed, maybe even horrified, just because in some ways it is at odds with who he was as a human being for however great a figure he is in our history. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, he was a man, he certainly had his own sizable ego and was highly ambitious and took a lot of effort on his part to get to the White House and also to the command position in World War II. However, he downplayed it, he dramatically downplayed the imagery of the political trappings and the theater with which a lot of major figures surround themselves. That was a good bit of his tremendous appeal to the average GI and also to the average American. The average American saw his great value as a president far earlier and far more clearly than us academic types. Although in recent years, in the last few decades, Eisenhower has been transformed from the allegedly do-nothing president who was the source of disdain for a lot of people, not just Democrats, but academics, intellectuals, writers and media people, as we've learned more about how he operated, especially behind the scenes, I think a more realistic picture has emerged, and he's rightly appreciated. Susan Eisenhower, one of his granddaughters, has a new book. There's now a flood of Eisenhower books of all kinds, and I urge people to read that important literature. She's got a new book out about his leadership, and she emphasizes that and notes he himself was buried in his plain army uniform in a plain wooden casket. That was very much his style.
Something else you mentioned in your column about Eisenhower as president that I probably knew at one point but certainly had forgotten is the fact that for most of his two terms, I think you say 6 of the 8 years that he was president, the Congress was pretty much controlled by the Democrats. And so that is a situation that can be very, very tricky for a president to navigate for all the powers that that they might possess. Am I remembering that correctly? And tell us how President Eisenhower contended with that.
Well, he was a great coalition builder. He led the largest and most complicated military alliance in history, including the Soviet Union. And Joseph Stalin was a difficult and very foreign leader, to say the least. Our French friends, the Free French, led by Charles de Gaulle, from the enormous to the initially minuscule, were also a very difficult person. Eisenhower had this remarkable ability to get people to work together, and that indeed is a big reason why President Roosevelt and General George Marshall, the chief of staff of the army at the time, but the singular military leader and advisor in terms of the president's view of how things should be handled. They both noted, among other things, that Eisenhower has this unusual ability. Men and women want to follow him. And that was so distinctive. That was one characteristic that they seized upon. Actually, give you a straight answer to your question. The Democrats were led by Lyndon Johnson in the Senate and a very long, very great Speaker of the House of Representatives, Sam Rayburn of Texas, both of Texas. Eisenhower didn't care for either one of them. He didn't trust them. He disliked an awful lot of people, about which he would express himself quite privately. Interestingly enough, he predicted that if LBJ gets to the White House, he will go insane, which in my personal opinion is exactly what happened in the terrible ordeal of the Vietnam War a decade later. But Eisenhower, when they were all in town, he would meet with both of them sort of after the workday and have them over to the White House. He was a non-drinker, but basically, and alcohol was rarely served at the White House, but for these two Texans, especially Lyndon, it was present in profusion. And through that process, intense partisan differences, which are always with us, and they were certainly with us in the 50s, the poisonous nature of the McCarthy era was far more deeply rooted and far more destructive than anything that's going on today, in my opinion, despite our great collective anxiety and sense of frustration about partisan politics collectively. It was a good example of his effectiveness as a leader. The hidden hand president is one term that's been coined by a Princeton professor to describe his style. And it was very much that way. He also worked extraordinarily hard and into old age had this tremendous energy and ability to focus and exceptional intelligence. Not at all an intellectual, but a very, very effective intelligence. He finished first in his class. In every class, the Army is a great educational institution along with the other services. Eisenhower did not do well at West Point. He excelled as a football player, but he was not a great student, and he liked to emphasize that later. What he covered up was that at the Commander General Staff's College, where Marshall first noted him, and these other almost endless educational assignments that ambitious officers receive, he was always first in his class. It was just phenomenal.
A last question, Eisenhower. Tell us that he has been reassessed quite dramatically in years, as though he was really largely misunderstood although appreciated by the general public. Is it just that documents have come to light, or I mean, how do you explain this dramatic reassessment of him? I mean, why do we know so much more now that we didn't know once upon a time about what kind of leader he was?
One of my favorite articles about Ike appeared in Esquire magazine in 1967, which was a in those days a serious and literary publication in a way that it is not today. On the cover was the GI in Vietnam during the height of the war, even though it was before the crucial Tet Offensive the following year, early the following year. A GI who looks haggard and is wearing a peace symbol on his helmet. I think the fact that things were so challenging and difficult in the 60s and 70s, and the flaws of successor presidents were so dramatic, and we had tremendous instability until the Reagan administration in the 80s, with five presidents in 20 years after Ike, that tended to underscore, you know, why did nothing go wrong? What was it about this guy? So academics, he was always very popular with the public at large and with people who worked with him. But the academic community, which has so much to say with about how leaders are viewed and evaluated in history, took a different approach. Fred Greenstein wrote a book about the hidden hand president in the 80s. It was published, that did a lot to spark reevaluation. That literature was always available. Arthur Larson, who a professor at Duke University who worked closely with Eisenhower throughout the administration, wrote a book called Eisenhower, the President Nobody Knew, and it seems to have been the book that nobody read. I read it as a student, but that's, you know, that's me, hardly typical. But that book lays out in literally chapter and well-written verse what an effective president he was, but much overshadowed by the great romance of the Kennedy years. And as I say, the turmoil of the 60s. But as with other presidents, we become more realistic over time. I'm very glad to see that U.S. Grant, who was quite unfairly denigrated, partly because of the Lost Cause movement in the South that emerged right after the Civil War and became quite influential early in the 20th century, that he's appreciated as he should be as both military commander and president. He was flawed in ways that Eisenhower was not, and was severely tainted by corruption scandals. But the main point is it's taken more than a century to really appreciate Ulysses Grant for the great leader that he was.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College. He is here for his monthly visit to the morning show. Here, in quotes, we are together via Zoom to have this conversation. We're touching on some of his most recent columns, including the one we've just been talking about, focusing on Dwight D. Eisenhower because of the recent dedication of the sprawling memorial to Dwight D. Eisenhower, which has been erected in our nation's capital. Professor Sear, in a column that at least mentions the present in a little more direct
fashion. Excuse me for interrupting, but one other point. We've become kind of monument happy, especially in Washington, but not exclusively, a sign of tremendous wealth collectively, the great scale of our government, the great power and influence of the U.S., and some people might say a kind of decadence. But the Eisenhower Memorial is only the latest. We've got the World War II Memorial and the Korean War Memorial and the FDR Memorial, which is fairly recent. There's a plethora of nothing as gigantic as the tribute to President Eisenhower, but there is a kind of monument mania going on around the country. And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it's important for every American to think about why are we behaving this way early in the 21st century?
What sort of hunger is this assuaging is, I think, what you're asking.
Insecurity, a combination of insecurity and arrogance. And some cynics might say the last phases of a troubled empire.
Let's talk about the column you wrote about a speech that was given at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, former vice president, of course, a speech in which you felt Joe Biden did a really good job of hearkening back to our 16th president, Abraham Lincoln in ways that you found quite profound. Explain to our listeners what Joe Biden said in Gettysburg early in October and why it had such a powerful impact on you.
Well, the column, it's interesting how we read things. The column dealt much more with Lincoln than with Biden.
Right.
Actually.
Right.
And I thought it was significant and admirable, and I think very impressive that the Democratic presidential nominee went there. It's a good reminder of the importance of Gettysburg. And another thing, to me, in a more positive vein, even though it was a horrific battle that all Americans should think about and reflect on, he emphasized a house divided against itself cannot stand. And I thought did a good job of referring to and condemning, describing and criticizing the great divisions within our society today. And a main theme of his campaign has been the importance of unity. Also, it's useful to seize any opportunity to refer to Lincoln's great speech at Gettysburg. It's interesting, a house divided was actually a line drawn from the Bible, as is often the case with President Lincoln. It wasn't part of his Gettysburg address. He made a name for himself nationally and became a presidential contender when he was nominated for the Senate in 1858. He won the popular vote against Stephen Douglas in Illinois, as we know. But in those days, we did not have popular election of senators. And the Democratic legislature chose Douglas. Lincoln, however, shrewdly was positioning himself to be the second choice of Republican power brokers in 1860. And the House divided speech, that biblical imagery is really great. And I think Biden's to be commended for referring to it.
As you write about Lincoln, you use the word shrewd at least once, maybe twice. And talk about what an insightful strategist Lincoln was, in a way that we probably don't always fully appreciate. Tell us more about Lincoln the strategist that you think is important for us to appreciate.
Well, he was like Grant, he was a strategic thinker. And from the beginning, he thought of the war in truly national terms. The Confederates, partly for philosophical and psychological reasons, they tended to be much more tactical in their approach. It had to do with the kind of fundamental hostility to central authority. We focus rightly on the moral question of slavery, especially in our time, and we should, but there was another question of central, local relationships. Robert E. Lee, nobody in the Confederacy in uniform ever had the kind of uniform command that Lincoln, after desperately trying to find the right general, bestowed on U.S. Grant. There was something called the Anaconda Plan, which was developed by Winfield Scott, the very aged outgoing chief of staff of the Army, when Lincoln became president. The idea was to emphasize transportation, blockade the South at sea, conquer the rivers, especially the Mississippi, and effectively encircle the South. Lincoln also had this phenomenal mental capacity, like Eisenhower and other great leaders. He was more cerebral than Ike, but he really was a comprehensive thinker, and he literally found the time to become well-educated on military history, and he became a very effective strategist. But again, thinking in comprehensive terms, it makes sense, but it's easier to praise than to do. And back in the early 1860s, it was definitely novel for the United for anyone to take that overall strategic approach and use the tremendous industrial resources, not only think comprehensively in military terms, and Grant was a genius at that, but also think in terms of mobilizing the tremendous industrial resources of the North. Industrial democracies have generally won because of industrial capacity, as well as organizational skills that of a large scale sort that are not, they're not durable in a dictatorial culture. And fundamental reason, I think, why, why I thank God the totalitarian states of the 20th century, horrific and overwhelming as they could be for a time, they didn't survive. They're essentially flawed.
By the way, I want to mention that I recently recorded an interview that has yet to air with a writer by the name of Elizabeth Mitchell, and she's written a very interesting book about Lincoln called Lincoln's Lie. And the book, as much as anything, focuses on Abraham Lincoln's great shrewdness when it came to relations with the media, with the press in that day. And so it's kind of another example of another facet of what made Lincoln an exceptional figure and what allowed him to accomplish what he did under the most trying of circumstances. So I would commend that interview to our listeners to be watching for it when it airs sometime in the next couple of weeks.
Well, thank you. I will.
I want to give you a chance to talk also about a recent column in which you take us back to the tense days of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the early 1960s. This is like the writing you do on many occasions about Eisenhower is a theme that to which you like to return. Explain what prompted you to write about the Cuban Missile Crisis most recently.
Well, it's the anniversary of the missile crisis in October 1962, and the lessons of the ease with which we can misperceive what's actually going on, misunderstand the intentions of others. It's tough enough to deal with allies, but opponents especially. And since that was the closest the world has come to nuclear conflagration, I mean, it really was close. Like the Duke of Wellington said after Waterloo, it was a near-run thing, the damnedest near-run thing you ever saw. It's certainly worth, I think, reminding ourselves, worth me reminding myself and reminding people at large how important and instructive that crisis was.
What was it that allowed us to survive it?
I think Kennedy's leadership was really quite extraordinary. His errors, it's easy, you know, sitting on the sidelines, it's easy to criticize, and academics at some level get paid to do it. Kennedy made a major blunder, one of the worst missteps and disasters in U.S. foreign policy since World War II, was the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the failed invasion of Castro's Cuba at the beginning of the administration. The Kennedy people like to blame Eisenhower, and still do. Robert McNamara, the late defense secretary from that time, in the 90s, he was reminding people that the Bay of Pigs was Eisenhower's plan, actually nothing of the kind. He authorized planning to take place. Jack Kennedy did what Ike would never do. He simply signed off on what the military was promoting, and then he picked away at the plan for political reasons that made it even more flawed than what was initially presented. He took responsibility directly for that mistake. That, along with an unfortunate meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna shortly thereafter, led the Soviets, Khrushchev especially, to think that Kennedy would be a pushover and that they could easily get away with this. The Kennedy brothers, the Attorney General, his younger brother Robert, particularly drove this effort to overthrow the Castro regime and to kill, assassinate Fidel Castro after the Bay of Pigs. And it was not known to the American people, but the Soviets, and certainly Fidel, were very much aware of this effort. And I believe that was a further incentive for Moscow to take the tremendous risk of putting long-range nuclear weapons in Cuba. Kennedy having, as he admitted, made a major mistake early on. His performance during the missile crisis, especially in heading off what was almost overwhelming sentiment from civilian as well as military advisors at the start to strike Cuba's to strike Cuba with air attacks and then invade the island. He did a very good job of sidestepping that and negotiating us through a direct confrontation that could easily have led to nuclear war. There was a man named Vasily Arkhipov, a naval officer in these very, very steamy, very uncomfortable, very stressful Soviet subs around Cuba, who played a crucial role, and he's been rightly honored since then. This wasn't known really until the late 80s. The Soviets had nuclear weapons in Cuba, and for a time, Khrushchev, in a moment of insanity, gave his field commanders authority to use them if the Americans invaded. They also had nuclear-armed torpedoes, something the Americans did not have. These torpedoes would destroy the launching submarine, but also the targets. And at least one Soviet submarine being harassed by U.S. destroyers on the surface came very, very close to launching at least one of these nuclear torpedoes, maybe more, before they themselves would have been destroyed at the sizable U.S. surface fleet around Cuba. And Arkhipov played a crucial role in dissuading the sub's captain and another senior officer on board not to launch these terrible things. The more we learn about the Cuban Missile Crisis, the better President Kennedy looks, and also the more terrifying it becomes, the more details that emerge. They didn't really start coming out till the late 80s about just how close that confrontation was.
Wow. Speaking of interviews soon to air, I wanted to mention that I've interviewed bestselling author Tim Weiner about his latest book, which is called The Folly and the Glory, America, Russia, and Political Warfare, 1945 to 2020, in which he chronicles the kind of conflict that existed between our two countries, the United States and Russia, in the years after World War II, particularly when it came to matters of political warfare, propaganda, and so on. And he talks about how Russia has engaged in this for a long, long time, much longer than we are, and that in general they tend to be much better at it than we are because they have a vast experience, and that when we confronted this back in the 50s, for instance, in late 40s, we were newcomers to the game, at least to a large extent, and in some respects are still kind of playing catch-up when it comes to that. Any thoughts about that?
I was in touch with him some years ago. I wrote a very complimentary review of an earlier book of his, and I got a phone call as well as an email from CIA, something that's unusual for me, fortunately. And they wanted to correct some errors in his book. Obviously, he's visible enough. And also, from their point of view, unreliable enough that they make a point of pointing out errors in his work. He is very critical of CIA and of U.S. intelligence operations generally. And I look forward to reading his new book, but we should keep that in mind. The Soviets, throughout the Cold War, after they were our close allies and much idealized during World War II, we tended to turn them into demons. They make a lot of mistakes, and their intelligence efforts, compared to, say, the British especially, have been very ham-handed historically and currently. So I appreciate knowing about Weiner's latest and look forward to reading it. From the First World War, but especially before Pearl Harbor and the Second World War, our British friends gave top priority to working closely with the Americans. British intelligence, I believe, is among the best in the world, partly because they're not seduced by electronics and technology as much as others, including the Russians and ourselves, and they give high priority to human intelligence. Our intelligence agencies, the OSS, which evolved into CIA after the war, reflect to a degree those skills. I think we've gotten away with them. We've gotten away from them since the end of the Cold War. But the most important thing is to look at a variety of sources and then make up your own mind.
Very good. advice. You write in a recent column about North Korea and South Korea and about a rather extraordinary apology extended from one leader to the
other. Yes.
Explain to our listeners what was around this apology, why it was issued, and the significance that you think it has in terms of the future of North and South Korea.
I think the particular incident is newsworthy. It's all very murky. A South Korean government professional was captured by North Koreans. There's speculation that he was planning to defect, but he was someone who specialized in marine environmental, marine regulation concerns. A few miles off the coast of North Korea, he was captured by North Koreans, and the military wound up killing him. It was the kind of brutal incident for which North Korea rightly is known and notorious. But in this case, the leader apologized, Kim apologized to President Moon of South Korea and said it was a mistake. I infer from that that the COVID-19 has become so pervasive a problem that even the North Koreans are uptight and anxious about this strange plague. That was one factor in the military overreacting against what turned out to be an innocent, if maybe troubled, individual who was in no way on an espionage mission. And he was alone, and with no technology surrounding him when he was captured. The economic situation in North Korea is so terrible that I think that's reflected in this action and in others. And I remain reasonably hopeful that over time, economic reality will become so undeniable in the North that there'll be some accommodation with South Korea.
Your comments are a reminder that when it comes to COVID-19, South Korea remains one of the shining examples of what to do right, at least in some respects. It sounds like what they have done in terms of a response to COVID-19 has been in many ways impressive.
New Zealand, Australia, as well as South Korea and Japan, all these countries have just a phenomenal record of imposing conditions and the people following them in a pretty disciplined way that have limited the impact of the disease in terms of deaths and infections. It's just remarkable. So I think the four countries combined have something like less than 1,000 cases a day. I think it reflects the fact that they're much smaller than the U.S. in terms of population, at least in the case of Australia. But they're smaller, more uniform populations, not nearly as open and vastly open to internal travel, to say nothing of international travel, which continues to some extent in the current conditions. So there's a lot of, we're doing a lot of beating up on ourselves in this country, which is characteristically American in my view. But it's much harder to control the American population than any other large or small country in the world, arguably. China has a vastly larger population, also a big territory, but their record in terms of what they say publicly, my guess is it's a lot less positive in terms of reality. But a totalitarian dictatorship, which they remain, can much more easily control and monitor and regulate their domestic population than what is possible in the good old USA.
In our closing minutes, I think I would be remiss to not at least mention the fact that we have a major election coming up in just a few days, and certainly plenty of Americans who feel like a whole lot hangs in the balance. And I wonder what your thoughts are. I'm not asking you who you're voting for or who you have already cast your vote for, as much as I'm asking you about what you see as the significance of this upcoming election, however it turns out.
We were discussing President Grant earlier. There was a very interesting column, rather long one, in the editorial section of the Wall Street Journal over the weekend by an NYU professor. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but he referred to the election of 1868 and the media coverage at the time. This is the most monumental, this is the most important election in American history. That was only 4 years after the 1864 election, where in the Union states, President Lincoln was behind until the fall of Atlanta, and then he won. His Democratic rival, Union General McClellan, George McClellan, whom Lincoln had fired for very good reasons, was a Democratic nominee. He was a peace candidate, and he would not have pursued the war until the successful conclusion that Lincoln was able to pursue just before he was murdered. 1860. That was certainly an important election. There were no less than four major candidates, and Lincoln's election led to the secession of the South. The point of the column was every election seems to be the most momentous in American history. President Trump is an extreme candidate and leader in terms of rhetoric. I'm certainly not a supporter of his, but we tend historically and currently to exaggerate the monumental importance of any particular election. I am personally concerned. I think a saving grace of a sort with President Trump is he's more talk than action. With a few exceptions, his administration has involved a lot of personnel changes, a lot of rhetoric. I don't think the actual policies he's pursued have been a huge departure from the status quo, despite endless media commentary to the contrary. I am concerned, given my reading of his character, that he may do something extreme, including perhaps going to war with Iran if he is reelected. So as usual, we don't know, and I certainly don't know. But I don't think this is a particularly monumental election conflict and campaign compared to the past. I'm sorry that Joe Biden has not been able to orchestrate a more visible campaign. I wish he were more publicly aggressive. But that's my opinion, and you ask me, and I tell you. So,
do you have concerns that what is going on in terms of some of our most fundamental institutions, the fact that they seem to be under attack, does that seem exceptional to you, or is that actually part of a long history and just kind of the latest iteration of that? Attacks on the free press, for instance, and that kind of thing.
You mentioned our institutions. I think attacks on our institutions have been around from the beginning. We have a very free press. I believe professionalism in major media has declined in just the last few decades, but maybe that's the viewpoint of a grumpy old guy. I do think that the proliferation of media is very much a plus, but no, it's certainly nothing new. And the founders set up the United States so that we have no, unlike the British and unlike just about every other country in the world, we don't have a singular dominant institution like the British Parliament. We have constitutionally separation of powers that makes inherently for conflict. We do have a First Amendment guaranteeing free speech, which makes us unique among nations. And I'm reassured by the fact that historically, and especially currently, the Supreme Court, on a regular 9-0 basis, upholds the importance of the First Amendment and freedom of speech. I think that's crucial to the success of ours. I know that's crucial to the success of our system.
Very good.
We also, one important fact, we disagree on lots of different things. You and I have disagreements, I know. But whatever happens in this election, we have now had, starting with Bill Clinton, then George W. Bush, then Barack Obama, we have had three two-term presidents in a row, three presidents who have successfully completed, been elected to and completed their second term. The last time that happened was in the early 1800s, not 1900s. With Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. Turmoil is part, believe it or not, we actually have a very stable system in terms of presidential tenure in office. And in that sense, beyond the media public discontent, we have great political stability in this country in the 21st century and at the end of the 20th century compared to what went before. We're thinking about that, especially in these anxious times with the public health problem and the economic difficulties related to that.
Well, I always appreciate the long view that you bring to many of these concerns, which I think you're absolutely right. We tend to react to in the moment more so than we should. I mean, context is always helpful and in many respects is often reassuring. So thank you for offering that today. Dr. Artsir Clausen, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clausen Center, author of After the Cold War, and a monthly visitor to the morning show. Professor Sear, thank you again for being part of today's morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Always enjoyable, and you're always very kind. Thanks so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you're going to be hearing the interviews that I have recorded with the two men contending for the first congressional district seat in Wisconsin, incumbent Brian Steil and his challenger Roger Pollack. We'll be airing those two interviews on tomorrow's Morning Show. On Friday's Morning Show, we'll turn to the performing arts. We're going to be hearing first from Holly Stanfield. She is on the staff of the Kenosha Unified School District. She works at Bradford High School, and she is the director who is partly responsible for so many of the splendid musical theater productions that have been seen in Kenosha in recent years. We're going to be talking with Holly Stanfield about how that department is moving forward during COVID-19 and all of the complications that are being thrown at the school district. How are they going forward with theatrical and musical theater productions to keep students safe while giving them a rich and meaningful experience? That will be Friday. Also, we'll be talking on Friday with Jim Schatzman from the Choral Arts Society. They're going to be offering up a virtual treat this weekend, which highlights some of the greatest accomplishments which they have done in recent years, one way to stay viable and present during the restrictions of COVID-19. Next week's morning show schedule will include on Monday a conversation with Elizabeth Nitchell, the author of a fascinating book called Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. A fascinating look at Abraham Lincoln and his relationship with the media during his presidency. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 11 till 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. Don't forget your mask, and you can still shop online at jackandrea.com. And we remind you that the Morning Show is also available 7 days a week as a podcast, and you should look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on
Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. Yesterday's morning show.